What is up, everybody? Adrian M. Gibson here. What you're about to hear is the audio version of a live author panel recorded during TBRCon 2024, the latest edition of FanFiatic's all-virtual annual science fiction, fantasy, and horror convention, which streamed live between January 21st and January 28th, 2024. FanFiatic and TBRCon had the pleasure of hosting 25 amazing author panels, and we're so happy to be able to provide the audio for you for free here on the podcast feed. So, sit back, relax, and enjoy this fantastic TBRCon 2024 author panel.
Good morning, good evening, good afternoon. I think there's a bit of a delay, so I'm just going to give it a couple of seconds. Okay. Welcome, everyone, to the panel. I don't know what number panel this is on TBRCon, but we will be talking about fantasy, monsters, and mythical creatures, and maybe convince you that there is more to them than just dragons by the end of this panel. So I'd like to start out by thanking TBRCon panel 8. Thank you. We are in panel 8. And everyone who's here watching live and the recording as well. And give a warm welcome to all of our panelists here. And why don't we start with introduction. So I'll just go on the order that you guys are appearing on my screen. And if you can do a brief introduction and tell us your favorite fantasy creature. So Andrew, why don't you kick us off?
Hi. Yeah, my name is Andrew. I am the author of Being Prepared, Harbinger of Justice. It is a dark epic fantasy book. And my favorite fantasy creature, I feel like dragons like too obvious, so I'm going to go with a phoenix. I think that's underrated. I've not seen many phoenix in fantasy. We definitely need to see some more.
Cool. Rob?
Hi, I'm Rob J. Hayes. I'm the author of many books. I didn't come prepared because I'm currently on holiday, so instead I'm going to show off Michael R. Fletcher and Anna Smith Sparks' next book, which is not called A Time to Kill, it's called In the Shadow of the Dying, but this is what I'm currently reading. but if you want my books, I don't know, The Mortal Techniques. Oh, there you go. And for my favourite fantasy, I love creepy fantasy monsters, so I'm going to go with like giant spiders, or even better, like the Dryder, you know, like the half-human, half-spider things. They creep me out.
Awesome. K.S. Veloso, please.
So my name is K.S. Veloso. I'm known for my series with Orbit, which is Chronicles of the Witch Queen. I'm just grabbing it here. So this is the Broken Binding edition. And my latest release is actually a Kickstarter book. So it's self-published, but that's Otlo Mage. And my favorite fantasy creature, I'm a simple woman, so I'm going to say the dragons and werewolves. But my reason for liking them is really that they're not inherently good or evil when you see them. They can be both good or both really evil. So I really love that grayness, which like there's no preconceived notions when you see like a dragon or like a werewolf. Could it be like the werewolf used to be a human that, you know, the characters like? And so there's just like so much room to explore there, even though we've seen it so many times. But I like the freedom that comes with like not being like the forerunner of like, this is how dragons should be, or this is how like werewolf should be, just because it's been done so many times that you're like, go nuts. If you do something really unique with them, then, you know, people like it.
Awesome. I love that you touched on that, because that is something that we are going to explore a lot, I think, in this panel. Cool. Ed. please.
Hi, I'm Ed McDonald. I'm the author of the Raven's Mark series, which starts with Blackwing, and the Chronicles of Redwinter, which starts with Daughter of Redwinter. I've foolishly propped my laptop up by stacking books. I'll tell you what, the easiest book to get out of the pile without totally disrupting it is going to be Katrina Ward's Sunder. we have a lot of these around the house. So we got Looking Glass Sound as well. So, oh, no, okay, hang on. I can get to Blackwing now. There we go.
Cool.
All right, let me just rebuild my tower. My favourite monster. So I only like monsters in general that are out and out evil. I don't believe in good monsters. So I'm going to choose, and this just occurred to me the other day. I put these in my D&D campaign all the time. It's a particular monster from D&D. It's called the Gorgon, but it's not a Gorgon from Greek mythology. It's a giant mechanical bull that turns you to stone with poison gas. They can't be reasoned with. They have no interest in talking to you. They can't talk to you. They are just a pure force of cataclysmic destruction. And they're going to try and turn you to stone, then smash you apart and eat you. And they're very deadly and threatening. I like it as a rampaging force of nature gone wrong.
That's amazing. I have nothing else to add. Josiah, please.
Hey, I'm Josiah, aka JDL Roselle, author of a dozen books, including this one. My latest release is the sequel to this book, The Last Ranger, in the Ranger of the Titan Wild series. My favorite, or one of my favorite fantasy creatures, is probably the world turtle. Do you know what I'm talking about when I say a world turtle, or like an island turtle? I think the lion turtle in Avatar, The Last Airbender, is really fun. So yeah, I just love big, gigantic, but can be friendly, can be not, sort of creatures.
I've been kind of living under a rock for the past few months, but SPFBO finalist, The Last Ranger?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, okay. I'm not sure what iteration we're on at the moment. So yeah, it's current SPFBO, right? SPFBO 9, right?
SPFBO 9, yep.
Okay, cool. Awesome. I realized I didn't.
Who are you, Tiago?
Yeah, exactly. I didn't. I'm Thiago Abdallah. I am a Brazilian author who wrote this book here, Touch of Light. It's the first in the Ashes of Averin series that also has probably the reason I am hosting this panel. Book number two has a huge griffin on the cover, which is A Shade of Madness, and the prequel Prelude to Ashes. So, yeah, I think as you guys may have guessed, my favorite fantasy creature is obligatorily a griffin because, I can't choose anything else after this. I agree that, the exploration of fantasy creatures goes like beyond dragons, as cool as dragons are, as many ways as you can do them. I just think it's really cool to have this panel so that we can discuss, you know, all the ways that we can talk about this. So, awesome. Let's jump right in, and I'll kick you guys off with, all the questions will be open here, so we'll just keep it pretty loose, so anyone can jump in at any time, including the chat. So if you guys have any comments or questions, I'll be checking them and highlighting them, and we can veer off if that's the case. So let's start with what mythical creatures have you written into your stories, and why did you pick them? It doesn't have to be
like pre-existing mythical creatures or ones
that you create ourselves. No, it can be anything that you wrote, like Shadow Demon, for example, that gets into people's minds and makes them super aggressive and powerful. I don't know. Someone wrote that.
I quite like creating, as I say, creepy monsters, and that's sort of one of the main things that I really like to do with my Mortal Techniques books. I went deep into sort of the research of yokai in Japanese myth and legend, and I had a great lot of fun creating all the Oni and the Tengu and the Juragumo, and I'm murdering every pronunciation there. I'm really sorry. I can't pronounce anything. I really find those sorts of like little, the little obscure myths that you can then sort of like take and twist a little bit and turn into something completely different. So I create a lot of those for my Mortal Technique books.
Cool. And you have a lot of spirits in there as well, right? Like different kinds of...
I feel that spirits and monsters quite often do a lot of crossover. I know that if you look at something like Avatar that was mentioned, they've got the lion turtle, which is technically a spirit and sort of a monster at the same time. But then you've also got, I think it was called the Face Stealer, which is a spirit as well. Which is one of the most sort of interesting monsters I've ever seen in anything, really. It's like a giant caterpillar spirit thing that if you show any emotion around it, it literally steals your face, and then it can then wear your face. Which that was just, in what is essentially a kid's show, really. That was like one of the major monster plot points for one of the seasons of it. So.
So we're teaching kids to not show their emotions. That's the takeaway here. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. That could be the message. But yeah, so I feel like spirits and monsters often have a huge crossover.
Yeah. Along those lines, I was thinking about what's the crossover between like fantasy races as well as fantasy creatures and monsters and spirits. Because, dragons, they can be intelligent creatures, right? They can almost be considered, some are shapeshifters, right? So then they're kind of even closer to what we think of as kind of humanoids, right? But yeah, so I was just thinking about what is this line, they all kind of occupy a space of the fantastical and sometimes the terrifying. But there's just such a wide range and spectrum across so many different pathways. But yeah, along those lines, one, I guess, fantasy creature or race that I have in mind in my Ranger of the Titan Wild series is a sort of shape-shifting dryad sort of thing. The original idea kind of came, I was wanting some druids in my book, but I was like, I don't want to do just druids. And so they just started getting weirder and weirder as I threw other elements in there. And I think once you get throw-in shape-shifting, kind of like with the Face Stealer, I think things get a lot creepier because they can take some very strange forms. And anything that is humanoid but also throws in something else, I think is kind of uniquely disturbing. So, it gives a lot of material to play with.
Cool.
So for my own selfish purposes, I'm going to classify anything for myself as a monster. If I was trying to work out a definition for this. If it's not human or natural world animal, and it doesn't socially interact with the humans of a story on a regular, ongoing, daily basis. So elves and dwarves would not be monsters because they have, normal, everyday relationships. Fairies, ghosts, undead, everything else, I'm going to classify as a monster for my own purposes here. In terms of mythological creatures... in my latest series, The Red Winter Chronicles, it's based heavily on, I say heavily, I stole some bits, a sort of pseudo medieval Scotland, and we have clans, we have highlands, we have locks, but there are the hidden folk, which draws heavily on the sort of fairy mythology. If you look up Gaelic mythological creatures, it's dominantly sort of fae spirits. And we I have a monster called the Snatterkin, who Snatterkin are sentient sounds. They just make noises, that's all they do. And they don't make dangerous noises, they're just really annoying. And a lot of Gaelic mythological creatures are like this. They are, it's a horse, but it lives in the sea. It's a man and he only has one arm and one leg. And these days we'd be like, that's just a person. But in really Gaelic mythology, I think some of it you see, it shows how unknown the world would be and how frightened of the other people would be living in tiny communities where 40% of people died before they were five, and you don't know what's going on in the next town, let alone what's going on out in the highlands, in the wilds. So, of course, spirits are real. This mythology was things people, you know, the blue men of the Minch, they came and did their things and you didn't see them, but you don't see the wolves either. You know, like, you know the bears have been there, but they've run away. So, the hidden folk, who, if anyone's been reading Redwinter Chronicles, we'll see an awful lot more of them come Witch Queen of Redwinter, which is out later this year.
Cool. You know what I love about that is that there are just so many ways for us to use creatures to make the worlds richer. And that's what makes fantasy awesome to me. You know, it's like, okay, yeah, the story is important, the characters are important, everything that's happening is important, but it's just so cool to have these different perspectives. Like, you can just grab something from a mythology that exists in our world and then make it, you know, your own. And just like you were saying, I make it weirder and weirder, but you just call it weirder because you kind of like started here, but it's not necessarily weirder, it's just yours, right? And it that's what makes it awesome to me. So yeah, I think it's just really cool to hear about all of these things, because it's unique to fantasy, and it's something that I really love about it. Cool. Does anyone else have any creatures they like to? Yeah.
I wanted to show this. So this is in like one of my books, which is, it's almost a dragon, but it's not. And
that's
like
awesome.
I swing on the complete opposite of what Ed was saying, where my stories the monsters are the people usually. It's like and I go really hard, like really dark on the monsters. Like I go like dragons who are, you know, like pretty much consuming people and making people turn on each other. But it's the people who are the monsters. And I draw a lot of that from Filipino mythology, because in Filipino mythology, we have this kind of an umbrella term called the aswang. And the aswang is basically, it could be your neighbor. And your neighbor could be one of these creatures, and you wouldn't know until you like catch him in the middle of the night eating your pigs. And the next time, you know, they just fly off into the night. So it's there's this kind of anxiety where you don't know who is good or bad. The thing that looks bad may end up being like someone who actually helps you out. So I often have like so this dragon, we actually have like in the series that it's in, which is the Legacy of the Lost Mage, we actually call it Giggles, because it started out as like this almost like an eye of the beholder kind of creature. Like it's small, and it's like it was actually made from the fetus of a witch that she turned using magic, because she was so mad that these colonizers came and occupied her village. So she turned this fetus into this creature, and then this creature absorbs anything it eats, and then it grows in power. But deep inside, like in its head, it's just a little child that wants the parents' love and affection. And then at some point it eats a dragon, and then it becomes a dragon, but it's not quite a dragon. It looks like really twisted. And then now people of power start trying to grab this thing, as hideous as it is, in order to become more powerful themselves. So we have this whole like 6 or 9 books where it's like they're just trying to grab this dragon that's not a dragon in order to become more powerful than the next kingdom. So and that's where the question is, who's the actual monster? Is it the monster, or is it the people who like just refuse to let a child go to rest. So that a lot of my work tends to play with those, and I've done a lot. Like I've touched on griffins and wyverns and stuff, but like I always fall back on that kind of that exploring that pattern of people turning monstrous.
If, awesome. If I can just, it just reminded me of something. Sorry, I'll be very quick. My partner is an author as well, and she writes horror and thrillers and crime. And we've discussed writing things together, and then we come to plot out a horror story, and we always get to the same point, which is as we're getting towards the end, she will say, and that's when we realize the monsters were the people after all. And I'm like, no, it's a monster. No, it's going to come and try to eat them. And she's like, no. But really, it was in their mind. I'm like, I think we're coming at this from two different angles here.
Yeah. That just reminded me of, I don't know if any of you read The Life of Pi, but, you know, until the very end of the book, like it just, for anyone who hasn't read it, no spoilers, but it's this kid who's lost at sea on this very small boat with a tiger. But it's just like they keep going back and forth. He keeps like bringing back the crew on the ship who are really mean to him. And then suddenly, like in the middle of the book, you start asking yourself if the tiger or you know, everything that he meets, if they are actually a tiger or if he's just using them like to describe the people, like the crew on the ship who are on him. And I think that's just genius. And it's like, yeah, who are the monsters? Are they like the people or you know, the animals that we can't really deal with? So awesome.
That's one of my favorite things about creating unique fantasy monsters is you can tie it in with the theme of your story. You can tie it in with your characters. You can tie it in with the lore and the setting and the plot. Because you're making them from scratch in this brand new world, you can kind of just attach them to all the different elements of the story itself.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just like this huge part of world building that's so awesome. Makes it so rich.
Yeah, coming off of that, Andrew, one of my favorite fantasy monsters, I guess you could call it, it's kind of a spirit, but is the Shadow in the Wizard of Earthsea book. You guys know what I'm talking about? I love that, you know, I mean, it's kind of spoiler, but it's been out forever, right? So I love the reflection of the sort of the worst parts of the character of Ged's self, being the sort of the most monstrous thing that he's facing in the world, right? But it ties so well into the theme of the book. It is the theme of the book.
Cool, awesome. On that note, because we started talking a little bit about uniqueness, I think it's a good segue into our next question, which is, you can use examples, you don't have to get technical with this, but what makes a creature unique for you? Like in all the things that you've read, and we can use dragons, you know, as the example here, like what little element that, you know, the author decided to put in is what makes that completely different from everything else that you've read. Or something that you haven't seen before. And again, you can use examples if you like.
I've thought of this. There's a couple of different things that I think about this. Is there's the main like archetypal species and creatures, like elves are stuck up, dragons are killing machines, and dwarves dig too deep. And you can move away from that. You can do something completely different. I don't think you necessarily have to do that to have sort of unique characters and creatures in your story. I think this is more to do with races and species rather than monsters, but finding like the nuances in the individuals, I think, is a really good way to make it stand out as a character or a species or a creature. Because even if you lean into all elves are stuck up, doesn't mean every single one is stuck up. It's on a scale. So you can put more towards, you know, slightly less stuck up. Still stuck up, sure, fine. But less stuck up. And I think having that sort of not just a species or a race is this one characteristic is a good way to kind of still lean into the familiar, nostalgic, and archetypal tropes that people look for, but still make it kind of new and unique for your story.
Yeah.
Yeah, like jumping off on that, like I really believe that it's the author's voice that they'll make anything that looks generic on the outside really like come to life, even if it's like they used generic fantasy creatures, like tropes out the wazoo. But when you read it, then you get a sense of the author's voice and that this story really is trying to tell something, right? Like the author deliberately used those tropes or deliberately used the generic looking thing to make a point that makes it really unique to me, instead of like just kind of trying to make it unique for the sake of. But like, yeah, there's something that comes out that's like basically nobody else can mimic because it's the author's voice.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes total sense. I hadn't thought about it in that way. Like, I always thought about it as more like a building Legos, you know? Like, okay, I'm gonna build this creature and get this part from this creature and this part from this creature and build this monster here. But yeah,
like, kind of like how you put it together, that's your unique vision, right? Like it's like the more that I see of the author in the work, because you can be more workmanlike and just like not put your own take on it, but I love it when I see the author's take, and I don't even care if it like hits my marks. Like, if the more of the author's voice I see in it, that really makes it come alive for me.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes perfect sense.
Yeah. Going off. Go ahead, Ed.
No, you go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. Going off case a little bit. Along with voice, it's kind of what I see it as is connecting it really intimately into the world and the plot and the characters. Just every kind of creature seems like it should make sense within that world, right? And not that you can't deviate from that, right? Have something totally left field that can work. But I liked to make it seem so, like, for example, in my series, I have these titans. They're called titans. They're basically take the form of any kind of creature. So a dragon, for example, but the dragon is made out of smoke and ash, right? So it connects well into the world because there's a bunch of these different kinds of titans, and there's reasons for why they appear the way they do. And you, as you unfold throughout the series, right? So everything kind of connecting to the magic, connects to the way the societies work, because they all have to work around these titans. I think that just really makes it feel like, sure, there's a dragon, but it's not like the same dragon, right?
Yeah.
So I was going to say, in terms of uniqueness, I mean, I think if you can describe it by a generic name, it's not unique in the literal sense of the word unique, because unique means it is one of a kind. But what we're really talking about is putting what gives something its clear individual spin on a common theme. So I have a theory, and I'm going to sound a bit like I should be teaching a lecture at a very low-grade university now, because I made this up in my head when I was reading the questions. But I believe that those spins people take on monsters almost always reflect a changing social drive in society. And they are usually an outlet for the author's subconscious belief. So, for example, if we look at the evolution of the vampire, it's not the first vampire book, but if we go back to, let's start with Dracula. Dracula involves the fear of female sexuality, burgeoning sexuality, and female empowerment, because Dracula is all about, he's all about removing, but it's, I mean, it's also, you know, he's not only draining women. But at the end, we've got the question of, is Mina going to become a vampire, which is left completely unspoken. If we move right on forward through our vampire canon, we'll go through like Nosferatu, which is the, you know, cinematic vampire. It's cinematic, so you need something visual. So you make the most hideous looking vampire you can. get to Buffy the Vampire, all the way fast forward to Buffy the Vampire Slayer. We've got the very sort of poorly understood 90s feminism where thinking, saying you go girl and go power was somehow akin to social equality, and not realizing that, yeah, like making a hot vampire slayer girl isn't the feministic ideal you think it is. But then we go to Twilight. What's Twilight? It's excuse for patriarchal bad boy relationship mythology where he would like to kill her, but he just loves her too much and she can change him. You know, like, and so we have this, it's whatever is happening in the zeitgeist is what's driving the changes to these ways of telling stories. Frankly, as far as I'm concerned, if it doesn't want to suck your blood and eat you, if it's not a remorseless killing machine, it is not a vampire. It is some bullshit. Sorry, pardon my French. But I feel very strongly on the subject of vampires. So, I mean, is a sparkly diamond skin vampire unique? No. What it's doing is drawing on your common... I think this was said already, but it's drawing on your common understandings and then subverting them to make a particular point. And that's what gives it its unique flavor, if you will. But I think most monsters are written to, they encapsulate the themes of a zeitgeist. In Beowulf, what's Grendel? Grendel is a big man who comes to your hall and kills you in the night. If you're an Anglo-Saxon in the 10th century, that's very frightening. Like, it's too basic for us. Grendel's mother, what is Grendel's mother? She just lives in the swamp and she kills you as well, you know? But those are terrifying themes to an Anglo-Saxon because you're living next to the swamp in your log cabin. So that's how you make them, that's how you make those monsters frightening. And so I think if any of us authors here look at what sort of monsters do we create, I create monsters all the time that look exactly like children. Why? Because I can't think of anything more frightening.
I was going to say, you've got in your Blackwing series, you've got the little things that paralyze people and then devour them, and they're constantly spouting gibberish. They were terrifying.
Yeah, they're little red toddlers who eat you while you're asleep.
Yeah. They stuck with me. Children, it's been years since I read that trilogy, but those ones stuck with me.
I 100% agree, because children in real life are scary enough. Like, as a father, I can tell you that, you know, it's scary enough to have kids. So yeah, building monsters based on children is, doesn't get much scarier than that for me either. The only like follow up question that I have for you, Ed, is have you written vampires into your books, and if not, when?
Well, it comes up like, how much of a vampire's mythology does something have for it to be a vampire? And what can we cut out and still be a vampire? So I have creatures which are, they don't age. They don't need to eat conventional food or water. They don't like sunlight. They're undead. So they share a lot of vampiric traits, but they don't adhere to any real specifics, but they're pretty close. I mean, I love a vampire, but for me, a vampire is a malignant force of evil. It is a predator. And I mean, I feel like modern vampires have just got really hard done by the fact that people really want to get with them. Right? Like, I know that sounds stupid, but like all our contemporary vampire fiction is about people hooking up with vampires, which represents, I think, the zeitgeist of increased liberal thought about people's sex lives, and that it's okay to want what you want, and it's okay to say, hey, this is a bit of a kink that I have. And people, you know, well, look at Romanticy, frankly, it's an entire genre based on that concept, which is great because people should get to enjoy what they like. But vampires, I have a vampire screenplay that I'm planning to write. It's set in an American high school. The vampire is a cosmic force of evil. But we'll see. We'll see. I mean, no one's gonna make that rubbish. No more vampires in high schools.
You never know. Let me just sorry, I don't want to cut anyone off if anyone has anything else to add to this question. Please do. Otherwise, I just want to use one of the chat questions here because it's similar to something that I was gonna ask you guys. So I had a question in there that was, is there any creature you avoid and why? And I think it ties well into this question, which is what can ruin a great monster in anything that you've read? So
I think that can depend on the type of monster. If you've got something which is a good sort of scary monster, you know, a terrifying monster, I think over description quite often ruins it because it's the unknown. It's that sort of like, you know, what is it, that quality that quite often makes it as scary as it is. So if you're going into over description to the point where you're like, ah, yes, it had claws as long as it and toes as long as, ah, and teeth and that, it can quite often get to the point where you're like, yeah, I can see it perfectly. Because if you think about you're watching a horror film, so many times the monster is terrifying until they show it. And the moment they show it, you're like, eh. But while it's that unknown force that's, yeah, like hunting people, that's picking people off or anything like that, that's when it is terrifying. And when it can be anywhere, it can be just behind you at any time. That's the terrifying bit. And then,
unless it's a child, you know, it's, and then it gets scarier.
Well,
when you see it.
There's one exception to this rule. That is absolutely true, Rob. There's one exception, which is the Geiger alien. For some reason, it's just more scary when you see it.
Well, it is to a degree, but then if you overuse it, again, it stops being scary. If you look at the later Alien films where they're just like, I mean, not aliens, but ones after that, when they're coming out of everywhere and you're like, ah, yeah, they stop being quite as scary. But
I'm more scared. More and more scared.
But certainly, like, in Aliens, because to be honest, you rarely saw the alien in Alien. You saw, like, bits of it every now and again. You kept seeing, like, close-ups of its, like, mouth going. And that was quite terrifying. Or just, like, you know, flashing a light in the darkness and you see it going. Very terrifying. But you rarely actually saw it just lumbering towards you. Partly because they couldn't really make it quite so scary. If it's just a dude just walking down the corridor in a...
That's how they walk.
That's definitely, yeah, they strut, man. Have you never seen an alien? It just struts down the corridor like, hey. I don't know. Where was I going with that one? I got lost. The strut, it completely confused me now. Anyway, if you don't show, it's the moment that you show them, I think that most monsters stop being scary.
I completely agree. And I'll pass it over to you in just a bit. I think the unknown, what makes the unknown terrifying is that we fill it in with what we find most terrifying. So when they don't show like the creature or the monster, it's like, oh, okay. And then your brain fills it in for you. And it can't be, you know, more terrifying than what you've already created that's terrifying for you. So when they show it, usually it can be a little underwhelming. I agree.
On that note, I also don't like it when they just start to, like, talk about the creature, like its habits, its feeding habits, where it's like, you turn it into Pokemon. Where it's like, okay, yeah, that's a grass type and it lives there, and like as soon as you have like one of those characters who just know everything, it really ruins it for me, because it's like, you know, you can't categorize everything unless you use that to throw the reader off, and then the monster is completely different. That's when I love it. Like, but otherwise, if there's like a you can put it in a book, right? Like they're reading a description that comes in like an encyclopedia where there's like, oh, this kind of monster is like this. And then the monster acts exactly like the book says. Then, yeah, that really kills it for me.
Well, I quite like Pokemon, so, you know, I'm a fan of that.
I love Pokemon, but it's not like, it's not horror.
Yeah, I mean, not every monster needs to be horror or horrific, right? Yeah, it doesn't need to be monstrous, even though you would think it would need to be. But like Witcher, for example, is one that and maybe you were thinking of that. It's one that categorizes monsters as much as it can, right? And yet the monsters continue to feel monstrous until, you know, you figure out, you know, this one is kind of actually kind of nice and misunderstood. That happens a lot, right? But I think it can be used for misdirection. It can be used to show how we can't, we strive to understand monsters. And yet even that often is not enough to really overcome the obstacles that they pose. I don't know. It can be an interesting flavor, but it can be overdone too.
So I think something that the point at which it's really easy to ruin a monster is when characters beat it and it is not the climax of the story. So if you think about minion monsters, like, you know, the unnamed, unwashed, spear carrying hordes. I'm doing a listen through of the Fellowship of the Ring again at the moment on Spotify to go to bed, because it doesn't matter if I fall asleep. I've read it 50 times. And then when they meet orcs, they beat them. They beat them in large numbers. So everyone is like, orcs are coming. I mean, does it matter? Like, they take out 14 of them the first time they fight and no one gets injured. So if we see the villain, and you know, this is the setup for children's television, isn't it? Like in Power Rangers, they beat the bad guy every single time, and you know they're going to beat it because that's what kids need. They don't want to live in fear, right? Whereas adult readers, we like a bit of fear. We want to be afraid of the monster, but if we see the bad guy, especially that, you know, whatever the chief monster is, being defeated and bashed on the head and having to run away, it's not very, I think they lose all their impact. I want every encounter with that villainous monster to leave the characters on their knees as they just get away every time, you know, and it should cost them something just to run, because that gives it its monstrous power. Oh, yeah, like the Forsaken in Wheel of Time are a really good example of this. Oh, no, the Forsaken, the greatest wizard of the age, end of book one. Sorry, guys, spoilers, but it's been out since the 80s. Two, in one shot. Oh, no, more Forsaken are coming. So what? Like, does it matter?
I mean, to be honest, were they even mentioned in the entire book? It's been a while since I read book one. It's like a couple of years, but I don't remember them being mentioned at all. And then suddenly at the end of the book, they were like, hey, there's two guys who are apparently really powerful because we're not having the really big bad guy just yet. So here's some others that we've not mentioned at all.
And Jordan even brings some of them back to life about six books in, because he's killed off too many of them. And then it's like, oh no, the Forsaken are back. And it's like, but just handle it, guys. You're going to be fine. You're going to be totally fine.
Yeah, I think this is linked to, you know, when the author kind of backtracks a bit. It's like, doesn't necessarily have to be a monster, but like, oh, there's this deadly disease that has no cure. And like, I don't know, they spend an entire book talking about it. And then suddenly in book two, it's like, oh, wait, we found a cure. It was hidden all this time. And it's like, I think it's in that vein. Yeah, I agree that kind of ruins everything. Like, if you're gonna make a monster be the villain, then just make them be powerful. Otherwise, what are you doing? But I will say that, you know, them beating orcs makes the Uruk-hai a little bit scarier, because the Uruk-hai are powered up orcs. So
what happens when they meet the Uruk-hai? What happens the first time they meet the Uruk-hai? How many does Aragorn kill on his own? All of them. But
Boromir kind of dies. Is it the first time? I don't know.
Boromir has to be shot with arrows, because the Uruk-hai cannot kill anybody with a melee attack. Yeah. They fail to kill one principal character. I think in the book, actually, like, they just all have bows. In the movie, they made it, there's a special one that has bows, you know. Yeah. But they still, they can't even take on hobbits. They can't even be a hobbit.
Yeah, no, I agree. I understand. I remember being terrified of the chase when I read Lord of the Rings. but I was a kid, so yeah. Cool. Does anyone else?
Just on the Lord of the Rings point, if we just compare that to the Balrog, the Flame of Arnor, when the Balrog turns up, it's in it for, what, 2.5 pages? And then it's gone out the book again. And you have no idea what it is. It's hardly described. It's given a brief description. Its size, I don't think, is mentioned. And the only thing it says about wings is it has the shapes of shadows at wings. You don't know anything about it, and then it's gone. That's a great monster.
Yeah.
I think the other side of things, as Sarah mentioned, is like, you know, not all monsters have to be terrifying or creepy or anything like that. But I think one thing that can ruin monsters, even if they're not creepy or terrifying, is just being too common. Like, dragons are, you know, undoubtedly awesome. Everybody loves dragons, okay? However, they kind of stop being quite so awesome if they're just everywhere all the time. If everybody's just, like, looking up and say, like, oh, yeah, and then there was a flock of dragons just flying past, they stop losing that sort of, like, that thing that makes them special, that makes them, you know, wonders, and they start becoming too commonplace. And I think that's how you can ruin monsters, even, you know, not sort of, like, creepy or terrifying type ones.
I think it's like if you played Skyrim in the beginning, like when they talk about the dragon, it's always like, oh my god. And then suddenly you get so powerful and you're shooting the dragons from the sky and you're like, okay, yeah, I get to loot it.
Yeah, you can't walk 2 steps without running into a dragon. And you're like, oh, yeah, like, not another one. Yeah.
Like in the beginning, it's so scary because they're like the first time you see one. But then after you get so powerful that you're just shooting it out of the sky and looting it for gold so you can sell its parts for gold. Then suddenly it's like, oh, a dragon. It's like a free meal.
Yeah, right.
Funnily enough, I remember I think I was playing Dragon Age Inquisition. And the first time I saw a dragon, it was fighting with a giant, and I'd literally just gone through this cave, and I'd come out from this cave mouth, and there's this dragon just fighting a giant. And I just stopped there and watched it. It's just like, you know, bloody hell, that's amazing. And I was watching it for about 5 minutes. And then, yeah, by the end of it, I'd seen so many dragons, I was just like, oh, look, there's another one. Charge into battle! So again, yeah, it's just, if you make them too common, they really lose that wonder, that specialness about it.
Yeah, Pete has a point here. If you go all the way opposite, yeah, then maybe you create an eldritch horror of dragons or something, and then that becomes one big.
I used to do that on Skyrim where I would like generate a code to like test my system, and then I would have like, I don't know, like 100 dragons in the sky. Just like it's nice to watch for a few minutes.
Awesome. I'll get to a few more of the chat questions in a second. I just have 2 questions that I really want to ask you guys. So is there a creature that you'd like to write, but for any reason haven't had the chance to yet?
Sure, I can go. I got one in mind. So I will be writing these in an upcoming book, but they're like werewolves or werewolf, you know, equivalents. So I avoided them for a very long time because of all the connotations, like the modern connotations that come with werewolves, like the romanticy sort of stuff. And that's not my intention with them. But there's something very cool about shifting into an animal that can, and like the experience of that, that can be like kind of horrifying, kind of wondrous. And I really wanted to explore that. So I finally gave in, and I'm going to be writing that soon.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you can kind of use the modern connotation in your favor, right? Because if that's what people expect, then you can just subvert expectations on a whole new level and make it awesome.
And I'm avoiding the word werewolf intentionally. I think I do this often with things that are really laden. I mean, sometimes not, but sometimes if something's too laden with connotations that I don't want, I'll just use a different word, right? And maybe they can get it from the description, maybe they don't, but either way, it feels a bit more fresh when it is labeled differently.
I think like where other animals, like werefox, werecat, were whatever, are some creatures that are awesome and are very underutilized. I see them on like D&D sometimes, or you know, like Magic the Gathering has cards with creatures on them, but like a were-rat, for example, must be something that's terrifying, like a human-sized or bigger, like, rat.
But that's just it. I mean, quite often when you see those sorts of things, they're not. They're just like, oh, it's just, here's a were-rat, and it's just a big rat. Whereas the whole thing about a werewolf is it's a person that changes into a wolf, or possibly the other way around.
The idea is to make these creatures like a person that changes into a rat as well, like, you know, huge.
Not quite as scary, is it, though?
Like
the traditional werewolf turns into an actual wolf rather than we often see werewolves as the hybrid form, don't we? But like even in its hybrid form, what advantage has it gained? It's gonna eat anything. It doesn't have to eat the people. It's just a big rat. It's were babies, I mean, that you really want to watch for.
Yeah.
It's a baby, but it transforms into an adult human.
Or a human that transforms into a baby? Yeah. Or an adult baby?
Yeah.
You give me nightmares.
I don't know, that reminds me. I mean, Spirited Away, where it's got that giant baby. That could be quite terrifying, couldn't it? Just like lumbering around.
That is terrifying, yeah.
For creatures that I've not written, but I want to... So there's a bunch of monsters and creatures and stuff in my upcoming God Eater Saga books, some of which are called Terrors, which are sort of more like eldritch type things. But one of the sort of like more common creatures that I'm wanting to write is a Pegasus, because I've never written them, and I don't find that they're used much in common books these days. It's like, I think you used to get them quite a bit. These days it's like everybody just wants to ride dragons or whatever. I don't feel that they're used much, so I kind of want to have a Pegasus or two.
It's awesome. Yeah.
I write all the creatures I want to write when I want to write them. I don't think about what they're going to be before I get to writing it. I have no, like, I really want to write about A. All my monsters serve a plot point. They're always for something. They're never the theme of the writing itself. So, you know, if you're writing a vampire subversion, you're writing because you want to write about vampires. If we take the Gillings, for instance, that Rob mentioned earlier, the Gillings are the sort of 2 foot tall, chubby red toddlers with fins for hands, and the paralyzing saliva. So if they start to eat you while you're asleep, you just don't know until you wake up and they've eaten all the flesh from your leg. They are inherently a representation. Oh, and also they have 7 phrases. All of them know the 7 phrases, and that's the only things they can say. And there's one phrase which is the rarest and the most sort of frightening phrase. They're a representation of the landscape. They are its essence. They are corrupted people. They are inherently unnerving. They're also, their repetitive phrases is the mundanity of the horror, in that it's predictable horror. And the people have kind of, you know, they know the phrases. They've learned to live around, you know, with the understanding of these things in the world. But it kills you before you have a chance to do anything if you let your guard down. And so they're and I don't sit around at home. I'm not sitting there going, how can I represent landscape in my fantasy? What creature will serve? It's like, I'm just like, and then they see something and it's a deadly baby. My monsters arise as and when I need them for story points. And usually I just want them to be weird. I just want them to be as unusual and not seen before as I can do.
Well, you've convinced me about, you know, the monsters that you've described up till now, so I really want to read more than one of those that you described, so awesome.
I think I want to do a were-rat now.
Do a were-rabbit, do it right, damn it.
Yeah. I suddenly have this like vision of like somebody like bringing home a beautiful woman and then she turns into a were-rat.
While in bed.
Does it, anyone else find depictions of like rats as fantasy monsters? Like a rat which is like very overly fat is like a much more horrifying creature, because I think it plays into the idea of the rat has eaten your stuff already. And that's the horrifying thing about rats. They're trying to get in your food. They're trying to have your stuff. And so like there's a I think it's called The City. It's the fourth book in the Rats series, I think. There's a graphic novel called The City, where there are these hideous giant rats, and there's this bloated rat, and it's like, I think for me the idea the rats have already had your stuff is a primal fear we have. I think we revolved against it.
Yeah, I mean, I think rats are cute, so I'm the wrong person to ask.
But, yeah. not when they start eating each other, yeah. Which is, I've had pet rats, and when they did that, it just like flipped the switch.
See, Rob, people are already like, Cassidy has an idea here for your Pegasus.
Well, you know, needling children in the night.
Yeah.
Did Peter Pan do that? I mean, evil Peter Pan, I suppose.
I mean, Peter Pan is inherently an evil entity. So Disney just made him look good. I don't know.
Justice for Hook.
Yeah.
The last Peter Pan story I read was Lost Boy, I think it was, which is literally that sort of idea of Peter Pan as this sort of like sociopathic little child.
Yeah.
Captain Hook being the boy that actually did grow up.
Yeah.
It was quite interesting.
I think the original story is actually something in that vein. Like the original Peter Pan story way back when.
I mean, most fairy tales were quite sort of horrific and gruesome until they got Disneyfied.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Okay, so there's one question that I've been really itching to know your takes on, which is we've discussed this a little bit, but you know, monsters aren't always physically monstrous. So I want to know, you know, like what's the most unique monster or creature that you've come across that don't necessarily rely on physical attributes or the strength? And the example that I had for this was the Cthay from Kingkiller Chronicles, if anyone's read this, which is a tree, basically. You don't know if the monster is the tree or something in the tree. And they it can see the future. And it uses that as a weapon to be, like, super horrifying, because it can tell you your future and manipulate you to do stuff or not do stuff. And the way that it manipulates you, I just think is kind of genius. So in that vein, is there anything that you've come across that you found, wow, this is awesome?
I kind of like the Reselka in Guy Gabriel Kay's Tigana, which is like, it's kind of based on the Rusalka of Slavic folklore. But it just stuck in my head, because like every time that he wants to emphasize something in the story, like the emotional depth or whatever, then this thing shows up. And it's not like it's not the monster itself, but just like the way it weaves into the story. So it's not even so much as a physical threat or that they're scared of the monster or anything. It's almost like it tells them their future. That's how they had it made. So it's like the fear is for your own life, like for your own life down the line, like what's going to happen to me, like this thing that I'm doing, it's not going to work out or whatever. So it's that unique thing where it's the scary part is not the monster itself, but what the monster foretells.
Awesome.
I had something very similar in Master of Djinn. There's these angels, but they're not really angels. they're kind of just this being of pure light. But then they build their bodies with metal, and it's kind of like this ornate, horrifying, but kind of, they're described as beautiful looking angels. But the thing that's really horrific about them is that they see themselves as deities, they see themselves as gods, and they're not really explored if they are or not. But they believe they are, and they have this complete disregard of people. And every time one comes on page, it's so uneasy and unsettling, because they don't care. They just don't care about any of the other characters involved. And they're not violent, but it's just this complete uneasy feeling whenever they come on page. It's just, it's creepy, really creepy.
Cool. It's like they're so indifferent that they become scary.
Yeah.
I think that's because it's the idea that you can't relate to them because they're just so far removed. They as you know, human beings are sort of like inherently emotional, I think. And if something's like that sort of like level of just unemotional, not caring about anything, there's no empathy in it at all. It's really hard to sort of like to figure it out, really, because you can't see inside its head. You can't see what it might be thinking. And if it's not caring about you or anything around it, anyone around it, then that's quite terrifying. It's that lack of empathy that it could just kill you and it wouldn't even matter to it. That sort of thing. Yeah. It's quite terrifying.
I guess it goes back to the being mysterious and sort of this unknown, because they are so unpredictable. You don't really know what they're going to do or what they're capable of, because there is just this you can't relate to them. Like you said, there's no attachment to that.
Yeah. Cool. Anyone else has anything they'd like to share? Something they've come across that's non-physical but really unique? Let me just highlight a comment here, because authors are the real monsters. We all know that. So yeah, Mark, making a very true point here because of what we do to our characters. Yeah. Thanks for helping.
Not just characters. Mark's the real monster because, justice. Justice for justice, Mark.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of an example, but I think some of the scariest sort of types of monsters that don't use anything physical are the ones that it's the idea that they can attach to a person and siphon off the essence of a person, sort of thing. Because one of the most terrifying things about monsters for me is the idea that they can take away part of who you are. It's why something like Alzheimer's as a disease is so incredibly terrifying, because it literally dissolves who you are as a person. So I think having something like monsters that sort of can do that, that attach themselves to a person and sort of like steal things off them. It's why, as I said earlier, in Avatar, the face stealing demon is so terrifying in a way, because it literally takes something from you, and you can't get it back, and that it's theirs now. And for me, that's quite a sort of like powerful idea. Or a monster is where they can take away from you as a person. Yeah. They can steal something that makes you you.
Yeah. Yeah. Your identity isn't something you're used to being stolen, right? So, yeah. Cool. Let me quickly jump into a few of the chat questions here just to make sure that we have time, because I know we have another a little bit under half hour, but that goes by real quick. So I think this one will be a cool question to recommend a few books here. So any books with non-dragon mythical monsters you'd recommend? I'm going to get my...
I recommend Ed's book. Blackwing. It's got non-dragon mythical monsters and they're awesome.
Yeah, I'd recommend that too.
So my recommendation... Go ahead.
I'm going to go with The Sword Defiant by Gareth Hamran. I read it last year, and I've been in a real reading slump for quite a while. Probably about 6 or 7 years. I think after I started publishing fantasy, I found it incredibly difficult to read fantasy at all. My reading per year has gone down from something like 20 books to 4 books a year. It feels like work when I read the genre I love. And I read Gareth Hamerhand's The Sword Defiant last year, and it has all your weird and classic monsters. It's very Lord of the Rings esque. And it is just absolutely fantastic. So the sword, it says on the cover, "The Sword Defiant, the sword cares not who it cuts." This is an outright lie. The sword absolutely cares who it cuts. It's one of the major principles of the book. And whoever wrote that shout line got it completely wrong. Obviously hadn't read the book. But it's a fantastic book. The Sword Defiant, Gareth Hamerhand.
I love that.
I also recommend his Black Iron Legacy books because he creates some of the most awesome monsters, to be honest. There's the
Tallow Men as well.
Yeah, the Tallow Men are absolutely brilliant. They're sort of like, they are literally waxwork people, almost like constructs. But they're fantastic.
But moving incredibly fast.
Yeah.
Like they're not lumbering. They're like...
So, all of Gareth's books are absolutely brilliant for monsters.
Very, very off topic. I don't know if this is something general, but it was for me. Like, when I first played The Last of Us, it was terrifying because the zombies weren't lumbering zombies. They were like the plant-infected zombies that were really fast and rushed up to you and just destroyed you. So, yeah, just making something fast is a very easy way to make it terrifying. Especially if you're used to it being very slow, like just very quick. And then I know Mark just commented, people who know me are going to groan because I always recommend this book, but this is my favorite book like ever. And I just think Mark, he doesn't use monsters in a necessarily horrifying way, but the exploration of what it means to call something a monster to me is just genius in this book. And it's one of the many things that I really love about it. So I really
is this why Mark's in the chat?
Yeah.
Did you tell Mark, as Mark comes specifically to he's made a deal with you then?
Yeah, yeah. I'm his number one fan, so I'm you know, contractually bound to recommend his books. I really love the book, The Wooden Burn, and I really recommend it if you're looking to, like, you know, explore a little bit of what it means, you know, depending on who's calling who a monster. I think that's one of the amazing parts of it. I really love it.
So mine, I thought I'd recommend, is The Fifth Season by N.K. Jemisin. The Stone Eaters in that are incredible. I can't remember all the details to them, but I remember just being fascinated and just needing to know more and more. Like, in the whole book, like, I was like, what is going on with these Stone Eaters? So, yeah, it's a good one for that.
I love that book. Anyone else has recommendations of books with non-dragon mythical monsters? It can be, you know, like dragons used in different ways, maybe, if you like as well.
I would have to say Sarakis in Along the Razor's Edge. I loved Sarakis, and just throughout the series as well. Absolutely a terrifying creature, but the best part of it is that it's like a god of fear and darkness, and then when you find the main character agreeing with it, like, yeah, this is clearly a bad idea if a god of darkness is agreeing with you. That's not a good sign. That's not something that you should be agreeing with. So that was great. I really enjoyed that. And the origin of Sarakis, I don't want to say much because it is a spoiler, but kind of like the origin of that and how it ties in with the world building. Really fascinating, really cool.
I love Sarakis. I love that he makes me laugh as well.
Sarakis was very much a reflection of the character that it possesses, the character, Eska. There's a lot of similarities between the characters. Again, can't say much because there are a lot of spoilers, but yeah. Sarakis is a very interesting reflection of anxiety and depression, while also being the living incarnation of fear, yeah.
Cool. Let me just quickly run over the chat to see if I missed any of the earlier questions, then I'll get to the recent ones.
While you're looking at the questions, should we just do more shout outs for books we liked?
Yeah, absolutely.
Go for it.
So I want to talk about there's a book coming out this year, Genoveva Dymova's Foul Days, which is specifically about Slavic folklore monsters. We normally do this at the end, but I thought why not? The Foul Days are like 12 days around Christmas where all the monsters come and walk the earth. And the Tsar of Monsters turns up. You just basically have to hide from the monsters every night for 12 days. But I thought it was particularly apt to this panel to give. It's her debut novel, I believe. I think that comes out in about April this year. Foul Days. I strongly recommend people check that out.
I'll add it to the list.
Anyone else got? Anyway, yeah. Oh, we got one. Okay.
Yeah. So what's the question is, what's the difference in uniquity and derived? And in today's time, is anything truly unique?
I mean, I'd be curious to hear Ed's take on this because, the way you defined unique, what I thought was interesting. And I do kind of wonder if there's anything truly unique.
I don't want to take up all the time. I know I have a tendency to warble on. This is a semantic difference. What is truly unique? Well, the answer is nothing, because everything is simply made up of atoms, and there are no unique atoms. Every atom is replicated in billions of times. I think I largely sort of talked about this earlier. What we're looking for is the subversion of the standard that makes your story feel notably different. And I know we usually have aspiring or early career authors in the chat, and I always say that for a novel, you want your novel to be a book where within one sentence, people should understand what book you're talking about if you describe it. If you are writing a book which is specifically about unique monsters, it's the one where the vampires are sparkly. Yeah, it's the one where it's the one where the werewolves are hot. It's the one where the dragon they're dragon riders. Now, interestingly, Fourth Wing will have taken over in popular knowledge recently from, say, the Dragon Riders of Pern. Of course, there are other books where people ride Dragon Riders, but if you call your book The Dragon Riders of Pern, then that's the one about dragon riding. So it's what the twist that you put on the monsters and its level of prominence to the story. If you're writing Griffins, but the Griffins also are vegetarian, it probably doesn't make a significant difference to the story you're telling, as long as they still have teeth and claws. I don't know why they'd evolve that way. They're magic. It doesn't matter. The only importance on that is how they change the story you're going to tell. I should write a book about this for no one to read.
I personally don't think that it's an issue that's really worth worrying about, especially as an author. Whether or not your monsters are unique, I don't think that's what you really need to worry about. There's always a bit of a drive to be like, oh yes, it has to be unique. You have to create the unique thing, but I don't think you do. I think that if you want, as an author, if you want to write something that is literally like, oh yeah, I want elves and dwarves, and they're going to be like Tolkien-esque elves and dwarves and all of that, it doesn't matter. People will want to read that. So I think, in that sort of sense, it doesn't matter if you are creating the most unique monsters ever or anything like that. Just create the monsters that you want to create, whether or not they are unique or if they have been used 100 times.
Yeah. The common thing to do now is we just call elves something else. The mysterious folk. the pale men of the forest, you know.
It's the like, Eldrin.
yeah, exactly.
And space elves. It's
the same way we have to spell magic with a K. It's not the same as magic. It's spelled marginally differently.
Yeah, it's like spelling a sorcerer with a U, idiot. Never do that.
I think all this ties into what Gis was saying earlier about voice. And I think, you know, what defines your voice is the way that you see the world, right? Your mental, I forgot the term. I always talk about it, and then when I'm on a panel, forget it, obviously. But the way that you see the world is made up of all your experiences, right? So that is unique to you. So like Rob said, it doesn't matter. Like, I think everyone who's going to write like their first book, everyone's main fear is, oh, what if someone steals my idea? No one is going to steal your idea because no one can write it the way that you can write it. Right. It could be better or worse, but it's not the way that you're going to do it, because only you have, you know, the way that you see the world and the way that you build things and the connections that you make and the experiences that you have. So I think, you know, uniqueness is kind of born of that. And it's something that I agree with Rob. You should probably not worry too much about and just, you know, go with it.
Also, ideas are a billion a second. Like, we're literally machines for generating ideas. And the best concept can be, as you say, can be done horribly. But, you know, I can give you 500 different ideas, all of which I'll think are better than the idea that any author tells me they're writing, because that's what I like. We only sometimes think, oh, what if they steal my idea? Because we like it so much. It's made for us because we made it.
Yeah,
I think that matter of perspective is important. Because, I mean, yeah, something can be unique but not interesting, right? Because it's not interesting to you. So, I mean, that's what I focus more on, what is interesting to me. And typically that's going to be something that I haven't seen done quite in the way I want to do it. So, yeah, I find interesting is more useful concept for me than unique.
Yeah, makes sense. I'm gonna scroll down to a few. There's a question about suggestions on D&D creature guides and books on monsters. The monster manual usually it tends to be enough. It's a book with every D&D creature, like not every because they're creatures after that, but it's a book only on creatures. So the monster manual has got you covered probably.
I think you got Volo's guide as well, I think.
Guide to monsters. Yeah.
if you're a D&D player and you go on D&D Beyond and go on the homebrew and search for Gilling, G-I-L-L-I-N-G, I did make them at some point and put them on D&D Beyond.
Cool. I had the question and I lost it. Hold on. This one.
Is that like, so, do you mean like giving like a river or a tree or something a malicious sort of spirit to it, sort of thing?
Yeah, I think so.
I do that all the damn time. Because like there's I mentioned that I use a lot of like Filipino mythology in my work, and a lot of it is tied towards animism, which is like where like nature has spirits. So you could have like a mountain that's like a god, or you know, so yeah, like the god could be twisted and become malicious. That book has never come out yet. Like I wrote it a few years back, but it hasn't actually come out yet. But yeah, like
it's the same idea of sort of kami in sort of like Japanese folklore, I think. If you look at, again, something like Spirited Away, you have like the river spirit, the main character, I can't remember his name, but he's basically a river spirit that's also, you know, turns into a dragon. And at one point he starts getting corrupted by you know, something that he's eaten. And it's a similar sort of idea. It's like every river or every mountain, every tree has its own spirit. And yeah, it can be corrupted and turned into something, yeah, delicious, I suppose.
My entire Raven's Mark trilogy is set along the borderland of a place called the Misery. I mean, say it with a hammerhead. The Misery is a sort of post magical nuclear wasteland, which is conscious. The land itself I don't want to spoil it because you find out what it's driven by, but it is a conscious land which is permanently trying to kill you. So it changes the direction you're walking in. You walk for a day, you find that you've gone back 3 days. It will open and swallow you up. It is racked with pain and intention. So, yeah, that's the whole series.
Hello, McCrae has spirit dragons that are tied to elements in the world. So there's like a sea spirit dragon that can be pretty malicious as well, so that's something to check out maybe in her books. Cool. I think we have just one last one here, and again I'm very cognizant of time for us to keep it in here, but yeah, what do you guys think about the mystery of a monster's origin?
So again, I think this goes back to the idea of the unknown. The more unknown it is, the more sort of terrifying it is. And that can do with origin as well. I mean, it doesn't have to be. But yeah, if you've got a monster where, yeah, it's nobody knows where it's come from, nobody knows what it looks like, it's the nothing. It's terrifying. I definitely think that, yeah, keeping the mystery of it is absolutely perfect. You probably need to answer it towards the end, but then again, once you do, it will probably lose a lot of the scariness at it.
I had that with Attack on Titan, where when it first came out, I was so gripped by it. But then I think it took forever to get to the second season, so I started reading on what actually it was, and then that lost it for me. Now I'm like, oh, okay, that's what it is. Okay. And I've never watched the second season, but I remember when the first season came out, I was like, we were so hooked on it. We were watching it like we were binging on the whole thing. So, yeah.
It's almost a sort of self-answering question, isn't it? Because the fact that you're gripped on those things, on what are the White Walkers, what are the Titans? You can only ask the question because the mystery itself is what's interesting. The answer isn't interesting. Finding the answer is interesting, but once you have it, it's like you've seen the animatronic monster jump out of the closet. Oh, it was just a guy in a rubber suit all along.
The journey the character takes is what really elevates the experience, like the process of them finding out these answers. So I think if you're writing something like this in your story, you have to be very careful that you don't just you're so eager to throw it at the reader that you immediately show all your cards in a single page and then it's done. It's the process of finding out, deeply interwoven with the plot, that really makes it stand out.
So I will say there, on seldom occasion, the answer can be interesting. But so the Stone Eaters I was talking about from fifth season, I thought the mystery behind them actually was pretty decent. But in 99 out of 100 times, right, it's not as interesting as the mystery. It's not as gripping as wondering and imagining what it could be.
I think another thing that's done quite well is when something is resolved like that, you do learn the origins of a monster, but then it turns out that also creates this other mystery. I mean, a good example is Serakis in The War Eternal. You learn a lot more about him and sort of where his origin comes from, but then it just raises more questions because you kind of get this giant eye and crack in the world and things that even that's afraid of. So I think if you do resolve it, another good way of managing it is then creating more mystery from the answers itself.
or creating a motion. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, no, I'm just going to have to interject here and point out the fact that Serakis is not a he. Serakis has no gender. He's literally never described as having a gender.
I do that with Murderbot as well. I always just want to say he because...
To be honest, everybody does.
I was just going to say that learning that Serakis is afraid of something made me be really afraid of that something. because it's even like more mysterious. So yeah,
what does the incarnation of fear fear?
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry. Yeah, just what I was. Yeah, pipe it in with was if the answer evokes some kind of emotion, that can be effective as well. So I think tragedy can be a nice effective one, especially if it ties into what's going on with the characters, right? If it's like a personal sort of tragedy or a world level tragedy. So yeah, I think emotion in general, right, in story is very effective. So if you can tie it into that answer too, I think it's good.
Awesome. That's definitely true. Cause I mean, if you look at a lot of the sort of, the Japanese ventral spirits, you'll find out that most of those are, you know, or at least a lot of them are created via trauma, and it's learning about that trauma can be a good way to sort of like deepen the not the mystery of the character, but sort of like the ethos behind it. So it depends. It's like, yeah, you can reveal it. Sometimes if you do reveal the origin behind them, it can remove everything that's interesting about the character. But sometimes, yeah, the more you learn about it, the more connected you become to it, and the more you'll begin to care. In many ways, because you're sort of empathizing with it. Of course, that doesn't count if you've got Ed's monsters, which are just completely evil, no question.
Yeah. so we're approaching time here. I just want to give you guys a few minutes to do like your final plugs and talk about anything you'd like to talk about, your books, and say where people can find you. And we can start with Andrew.
Sure. Yeah, you can find me on Instagram at The Fool's Tale. You just search that with spaces in between, it'll come up because I think it is underscores, but I'm sure it'll come up anyway. You can find me on YouTube, Andrew Watson. Maybe put books as well to filter the other Andrew Watsons. And you can find my book, Harbinger of Justice, most places you buy books. The ebook is just on Amazon, so it's on Kindle and Kindle Unlimited, but the physical should be in most places you can buy books.
Cool. Rob.
Yeah. You can find me, I think, social media. I mostly use Twitter these days, which is my handle is at Rob of the Haze, or my website, which is www.robjhaze.co.uk, or all my books are available on Amazon. Yeah, that's about it.
Cool. Ed?
I don't do a lot of social media these days, but if you put Ed McDonald into Twitter, Instagram, I think I'm on Facebook, then you can find me there, edmcdonaldwriting.com. If you are in the US, then Barnes & Noble are doing a pre-order deal from tomorrow, 24th to 26th, where you can get up to 35% off Traitor of Winter, Red Winter, paperback, and Witch Queen of Red Winter, hardback, audio, and ebook, which are out, I think, in October and November later this year. So if you want to save some money, then please use that.
Awesome. Yes.
So all the monsters are like anywhere you can find books. I'm usually on Twitter and Instagram. Otherwise, like, I don't use Facebook for my author brand very often. So, yeah, that's...
And Josiah. Yeah.
Yeah, sorry. you can find me at jdlroselle.com. I'm on most too many social media platforms. If you want to support my current Kickstarter, I have one running right now for the third book in this series. It's called The Hidden Guardian. So if you look that up on Kickstarter, you can find that there.
Awesome. Again, I skip myself, but you can find everything related to me. I have a link tree, which is linktree.com/T Abdallah, my surname, ABDALLA. So yeah, it's just easier to get everything you need from there. And yeah, so I just want to thank everyone for the awesome conversation. I feel like we could have gone 3 hours easily here. Thank you for the chat, for everyone who's watching, all the questions, and hopefully we get to chat monsters again sometime soon. And yeah, of course, thanks to everyone who's organizing TBRCon, FanFi Addict, and everyone who's supporting the con. So thanks, everyone, and we'll see you soon.